The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So we do this practice to love what's already here and to transform ourselves and to serve with love. And these kinds of tasks are deeply linked. So maybe we can begin by just appreciating like all the goodness that's actually here. And what we notice when we actually pay attention to our mind is that the gravitational pull of suffering is much stronger than the pull of goodness. In the sense that suffering grips the mind, it has a kind of, it feels like a quicksand a little bit. It has this encompassing quality to it, and the mind just gets absorbed in suffering, and for all the things that are good in our life, we sort of acclimatize to that. You know, it's like what's already good doesn't require our attention. That's kind of on autopilot, and we trust that, and we turn the attention naturally to what's wrong, and there's always something wrong, right? The psychologist Baumeister wrote, he and some colleagues wrote an article that was been influential, and he was just picking up on a theme that was already evident in the research literature. But they titled the article, "Bad is Stronger Than Good." Okay? And here's some of their words. Bad emotions, bad parents, and bad feedback have more impact than good ones. And bad information's processed more thoroughly than good. The self is more motivated to avoid bad self-definitions than to pursue good ones. Bad impressions and bad stereotypes are quicker to form and more resistant to disconfirmation than good ones. Taken together, these findings suggest that bad is stronger than good as a general principle across a broad range of psychological phenomena. So what to do? I heard Joseph Goldstein talking about a kind of a mantra that he uses often when he finds that during practice, during retreat, he's in a kind of especially striving mode and trying to get somewhere, to get to goodness, to get something. And the phrase that he uses is, it's already here. It's already here. And so in our practice, we actually like learn to touch in deeply to the goodness already here. And there's actually an astounding amount. Just the beauty of the Dharma, the fact that we're alive, the fact that there are communities that gather like this in peace, you know, a kind of legacy of the Dharma and the like many legacies of love and kindness that we have through history. It's kind of staggering. And I've noticed sometimes like because I've been so deeply involved in Dharma stuff now for a long time, I find that I can almost lose track of just how privileged it is to be kind of like swimming amidst wisdom and compassion, you know, and the Sangha. It's just like, you know, some people literally not once in their life do they feel the depth of love that's possible on any day here or something like this. And that's kind of tragic. But here we are with whatever hardships or suffering are a part of our lives and marinating in goodness. And we do this in part, we love what's here, in part to give us courage to actually face what is difficult and transform ourselves for the benefit of others. So we do this practice really for, importantly, for ourselves. We're just another person. We're not, you know, just because I'm saying my relation to myself in some sense is not different than my relation to others. We're just another person and worthy of this care and transformation. And we do it for others too, because we know how deeply our lives are interconnected, how impossible it would ever be for our heart and our suffering not to spill out on others. That we are, you know, the human condition is deeply porous and we impact each other. And so if we only do the practice for ourselves, it becomes self-centered. But if we only do the practice for others, we never actually know ourselves deeply. And we actually want to do both. So there's this kind of esteemed psychologist and researcher, Marsha Linehan. Some of you may be familiar with her. And she's sort of best known for developing a treatment known as dialectical behavior therapy. And it was originally designed for people with borderline personality disorder, but now is being sort of used to address kind of emotional dysregulation in many, many forms. And she designed this treatment as with mindfulness really at the center of it, a lot of Dharma understandings at the center of it. And she really engineered it as a way of help, I would say, like helping people develop equanimity. That is a major aspect of it. And the patient population that she designed the treatment for, there are like very low levels of equanimity. And 5 years ago, every time I talk about this, I'm very deeply touched. In an editorial in New York Times, she disclosed that she developed this treatment because she suffered from the condition as a young person. And it's a very high level of emotional disclosure for a very, you know, a prominent academic and researcher. And she said, you know, that in clinical situations, patients would ask her, like, "Are you one of us? Are you one of us?" And she would dodge the question, basically. Then at some point she said, "You know, so many people have begged me to come forward that I just had to. I could," you know, I think she said, "Yeah, I owe it to them. I cannot die a coward," right? And so she shares in this very kind of moving editorial her own suffering with early psychiatric hospitalizations and the failures of treatment. And and so it's with that in the backdrop that I read the dedication of her, the second edition of her DBT, Dialectical Behavior Therapy workbook. And she's been a serious practitioner, and it's clearly transformed her heart. And you can hear it in her dedication. When I'm on retreats, each afternoon I walk and wring my hands, saying to all the mental health patients of the world, "You don't have to wring your hands today. I'm doing it for you." Often, when I dance in the hallway of my house with groups, I invite all the patients of the world to come dance with me. This book's dedicated to all the patients of the world who think that no one's thinking of them. I considered telling you that I would practice skills for you so you don't have to practice them. But then I realized that if I did, you would not learn how to be skillful yourself. So instead, I wish you skillful means, and I wish that you find these skills useful. And for me, it was a very, just in seeing that, a very kind of deep reminder that in this life we're all patients and all doctors, yeah? And our practice actually allows us deeply to be both, and for there to be a kind of inseparability between them. Now, sometimes we talk about developing wisdom and compassion, or awareness and love, and we talk about them as two wings of awakening and the importance of balance, and I don't dispute that. But in this process of transforming ourselves, there is some deep connection between the very gesture of looking, this gesture of awareness, and love. That they feel more and more inseparable to me, that the very turning towards, like the very willingness to look, holds with it a certain kind of love. And as one of my colleagues said, he even said like that he feels like attention is a form of love. That to love is to pay attention. To love someone is to give them your attention. To love them deeply is to give your deep attention to them. And that in our attending, in our this gesture of awareness, we are this is love in action, actually. So when we look inwards, what do we actually see, right? What do we actually see when we look? You know, not the kind of narrative of our life, but what do we actually encounter? You close your eyes and we get near, we get very up close with experience. What do we see? Well, we see that we're alive, which we've grown so accustomed to that it feels natural, but it's like almost unthinkable accident that we happen to all be alive, you know. And it feels like maybe a life of 50 or 100 years is a long time, but it's like not even the beginning of a blink of geological time, right? And yet, like, here we are, and we don't know what comes next, but we're actually alive together on this morning, you know? And that does something to the heart to actually appreciate this. We see that it's intense being human. You know, like, as adults, we try to kind of pretend like we've got it under control, and it's not a big deal to be human, right? Just living my life. No big deal. But it's such a big deal. It's like a big deal to be human. And I sort of have this image of like an adolescent on a first date, like trying to be like really, really cool, you know, just like all got it all together, right? And they're like totally a lot of intensity happening, right? Us too. Like, we show up to IMC, we show up to work, we show up in our relationships, and they're actually like we need to sense into the intensity of being human. And that's not a synonym for the first noble truth. It's actually everything has the potential to be intense. And so we come to open our hearts to this. We see that things change, and this is part of how we transform ourselves. We like really actually open our hearts to the changingness of all things. And from this perspective, our lives are like, you know, like a river with no banks, as one person said. You know, and there's a sense of like we keep trying to like climb our way onto the shore out of the flow of change to find a certain like refuge outside of change. But for the most part, if we're going to find a refuge in this life, it's going to be amidst change, through change, opening the heart to change, both in terms of at the grand level of people, places, things, aging, sickness, death, but also at the microscopic level of that there is no there's nothing ever standing still. In the sense, there are no things, only process. And sometimes it can feel like we stand on the ground, on the bank of the river, looking out at change. But we're beginning to appreciate that that bank, what we think of as the bank, is flowing water too. It will never be anything other than the flow of experience. And who you are, the fabric of your own being, is not less changing than that. We look and we see that we'll never know everything. That our capacity for understanding has its limits. So this is a physicist. We live in a bubble of information and can't know what's outside. According to the Big Bang, the universe emerged almost 14 billion years ago and has been expanding ever since. We have very firm evidence to support this theory. Now, given that light has a finite speed, it could only have traveled so far in this time. It means we can only get signals, information, from events that occurred within this bubble. The universe may continue out there, like the ocean continues beyond the horizon, but we can't know what's going on. This means that human knowledge about nature can't be all pervasive, that there are aspects of physical reality that remain outside our reach. This should give us a measure of humility. We see that how deeply we long to be at peace. You know, like this beating heart of like the kind of rhythm of this wish. May I be at peace. May I be at peace. Even amidst all of the kind of like painful rumination and worry and self-harshness and confusion, there is like this throb of that pulse of like, may I be at peace. And we start to get actually very sensitive to the way our bodies and minds are oriented around this kind of longing to be safe, to be happy, to be at peace. And the poignancy of that, like, grows, you know, and so we actually like feel that. We turn inwards, we sense our body, our emotional life, our minds, we feel our breath, we hear sounds, and we can feel like this, this consistent wish, like animating the movements of body and mind. May I be at peace. May I be at peace. So we develop this wisdom and open-heartedness to transform ourselves. And in that transformation, the heart is softened. The heart is softened. So Rilke said, the spiritual awakening that does not awaken the sleeper to love has aroused them in vain. And I have become, you know, more and more suspicious of the insights that don't lead to love. You know? At the very least, that don't lead to, like, a radical non-harming. So we've touched deeply into our own hearts, into our own joy and pain. that we begin to see this in others, that this is actually what becomes most prominent about others, you know, is not the kind of story of their life or their relation to you, or whether they're a kind of a pathway or an impediment to you getting what you want, actually starts to become like the sense of their longing to be at peace. Like, that's what actually becomes most prominent. That's what we see when we look in people's eyes. And we see that becomes salient in our own minds because we've spent enough time opening our own hearts to this wish to be happy. You know, and we've actually felt our suffering so deeply, so thoroughly, that we know the kind of understanding of how much a human wants to be free of that is at ready hand. So we live like animated by the noble truths. These insights manifest as service, as the attention is like becomes our own system, like the energy is freed up in our own system because we're not tending to ourselves with such intensity. We're not our lives, the self is sort of like begins to run more effortlessly, and the sense of always needing to be kind of investing our own energy in dealing with our suffering, that gets freed up. And as we feel like as our own inner life feels more safe, it becomes natural just to turn outwards. And so this is this aspect of service. And really, we purify the way the intention to care. We purify and cultivate, we develop this intention towards being of benefit in small ways or maybe dramatic ways. But this is a question of like actually purifying and enacting the love of our own hearts. And this again leads us back to a kind of fundamental tenet of practice, namely that of letting go. And so I would say what we're distilling out from our love is clinging. There's an R&B song, I think, from the 70s, a thin line between love and hate. Right? Really, it's there's a thin line, not between love and hate, but between clinging and hate. You know? And our clinging becomes entangled with our love. And so part of what we do in our practice is we're actually trying to distill out the clinging, to serve actually with no strings attached. And that means that that this instinct, like ordinarily what we love, we feel like we should hold more tightly, right? What we love, it just like we want to cling to it more. But then love gets entangled with a kind of possessiveness or control. And that always actually fatigues the heart and is an imposition on the other. And so what I want to say in the last few minutes is that we can love without holding on. And in fact, maybe the kind of deepest forms of love are a form of letting go. So we can love ourselves without clinging or defending ideas of ourselves. You know, we actually don't have to hold on to views, positive views of ourselves, in order to love ourselves deeply. We don't need to defend or protect or be anything in order to love ourselves deeply. In fact, all forms of self-clinging whether it's positive or negative views of ourself, become very fertile ground for pain. And so it's possible to develop like such a sweet sensitivity and kindness and care for ourselves without actually digging in our heels to what we think we are and what we think makes us of value. We actually step out of the whole realm of self-evaluation and open the heart to the existential situation. We can love others without holding on. We can love others without holding on. And this is especially important and maybe most challenging in our, you know, closest love relationships with partners, with parents, with children. Rilke said, talking about sort of like the best relationship is one in which your love for each other exceeds your need for each other. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no need. And in fact, there's like incredible courage in being open to needing another being. You know, to entrust one's heart to another, to be open to the, and like to the vulnerability of needing, and the potential to suffer loss. But can the love actually be bigger than the need? Like, can the love be a kind of letting go? Can we love in such a way that deeply honors the freedom of the other? Like, that's something that a psychoanalyst said, that love is the revelation of the other person's freedom. Love is the revelation of the other person's freedom. And so we begin to actually distill out the ways we cling and hold and control, the sense of possessiveness, of actually like a subtle way in which we think we own, or that kind of the momentum of controlling runs so deep. But that is an imposition on our own hearts and a kind of weight that the other must contend with. How do we be open to our own needs and love and let go? We can love our life without clinging to it. Yeah. And this entails like opening to the changingness of it. It's the finite nature of our life. And when we take our own mortality into our heart, as the Buddha asked us to do, one response is that the heart kind of collapses in on itself and we just can't bear with it and we can only imagine having more. But the truth is, even if we were to live for 1,000 years, it wouldn't be enough. There's another way we can take this into our heart, which is like life becomes radically open. Like the reality of our mortality like opens the mind and it's just like everything is open. And we can let go of Buddhism. We can let go of whatever ways in which we cling to this very path. And to let go of it does not mean that it becomes less precious or less central or less liberating. It means that we drain the egoic charge. We our own relation to the path is one of letting go. And then there's nothing left to defend. As Gill refers to, speaks about in the new translation of the Atthakavagga, uses this phrase from those verses: one has shaken off every view. And what better way is there to serve than to shake off every view and be just radically available, the heart radically available to what's needed. This is our poet laureate, Charles Wright. The more you say, the more mistakes you'll make. So keep it simple. No one arrives without leaving soon. This blue-eyed, green-footed world. Hello, Goldie. Goodbye. We won't meet again. So what? The rust will remain in the trees, and pine needles stretch their necks, their tiny necks, and sunlight will snore in the limp grass. Let's just sit for a moment. To love what's already here, to transform ourselves, and to serve.